Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Thursday, September 1st. The midterm elections are now a little over 2 months away, and signs point to Republicans winning back the House, which means Kevin McCarthy is in line to become the Speaker. But Tara Palmieri is here to talk about what happens if Republicans only narrowly win back control. Would that make McCarthy vulnerable to a leadership challenge from the MAGA side of the GOP caucus? And later on, Ben Landy will talk to Bill Cohan about Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell snatching away the easy money punch bowl. Can Wall Street sober up and get inflation under control, or will the Fed put the economy into a medically induced coma? We'll hear about all that and more in today's episode of The Powers That Be. Happy Thursday, everybody. Happy September. Welcome to fall. We are 2 months
from... Happy birthday to me.
It's your birthday?
Yeah.
I didn't introduce who's talking to me, by the way. If you're listening, this is Tara Palmieri. It's her birthday. Happy birthday.
Yes, I just interrupted your intro to happy birthday myself.
Are you a Leo?
No, Virgo. September 1.
Well, you got some Leo energy then, because I'm a Leo. Well, happy birthday. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
Before we get to a holiday breather, I want to talk to you, Tara, about control of the U.S. House. The Cook Political Report recently revised their predictions and said, while they think Republicans will still win back the House, they revised down the amount of seats they think they're going to win. The generic ballot has moved in Democrats' favor. They're now leading, according to 538. They're now leading on the generic ballot 44.5 to 43.6. This is a midterm year. The president in power typically does poorly in a midterm election. His party does. And now it's like seeming like Republicans might not take back the Senate. And then there's some Democratic bulls out there who think that Democrats might even be able to keep the House. I don't know if that's going to happen. But you've been doing a lot of reporting lately on Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House who would become Speaker of the House if Republicans win. What do Republicans think about their chances of taking back the House? And is McCarthy all but a sure thing to become Speaker? Or if it's closer than expected, might there be some kind of revolt within the ranks and they might not let him be Speaker? What do you think?
I think all of these things are possible. Kevin McCarthy has to deal with the House Freedom Caucus. He obviously tells donors and members, like, if we're not up by 15 seats in the next Congress, then I won't be Speaker, because there's a very strong contingency of House Freedom Caucus members who don't think he is conservative enough. And they think he doesn't have a strong mandate. They don't want to see him pulling his punches like he does. Like, they would like a more radical speaker, someone who represents them. Now, do I think that they have someone in their own ranks that could be leader? No. I know that Kevin McCarthy and Jim Jordan have made an arrangement where Jim Jordan will be the head of the House Judiciary Committee, which is going to be a lot of fun for him if they actually end up taking back the House, because they can spend all of their time investigating Hunter Biden, right?
Yeah.
But so there's like some deal making going on. They won't say if they're going to support McCarthy or not for Speaker. And they're trying to get some extractions and concessions from him, like subcommittee gavels or perhaps, you know, having some rules changed. The smaller the majority that Kevin McCarthy has, the more beholden he is to the extremes of his party, right? Which is giving everyone flashbacks to John Boehner in 2015. Everyone says, Kevin McCarthy might not have a hard time becoming Speaker, but he may have a hard time holding on to that leadership. And in the process of becoming House Majority Leader, which he was when Boehner resigned, and Paul Ryan was sort of plucked by the Freedom Caucus over McCarthy, because McCarthy was the House Majority Leader, so you would expect that he would ascend to Speaker when Boehner stepped down, but he didn't. It was Paul Ryan instead, and that was a big part because the House Freedom Caucus was just going to grow because of all these candidates that Trump endorsed in the primaries will likely win their House seats. And I guess think of them as like the MAGA wing of the Congress, and how they have a lot of power and they just don't think of McCarthy as MAGA enough.
Yeah, I mean, in Alex Burns and Jonathan Martin's book, This Will Not Pass, which covers basically the period from the 2020 election through January 6 and tracks both parties throughout that time. They write about McCarthy as kind of a, I mean, it's not a flattering portrait of McCarthy. You know, everyone sort of thinks he's just a social climber who likes, you know, social media clout. But a big point of their portrait, which again comes from a lot of Republicans, maybe on background and off the record, is he's not a guy with a lot of core beliefs. In the Boehner era, at the end of the day, like Boehner was sort of a like Grover Norquist, you know, kind of conservative country club Republican in the pre-Trump Republican era. And Paul Ryan was definitely that kind of like green eye shade blazer wearing Republican. McCarthy is probably checks the boxes on whatever he needs to check. You know, like he is, if Donald Trump supports him, he's good. He just wants the power. And if you are someone like Jim Jordan or Louie Gohmert or, you know, a true believer in the House, I think that makes him even more vulnerable than what you say. Yes, he's already beholden to the right wing of the House caucus if he wins by a narrow majority in November. But it's also like, you know, what does he stand for? I mean, like, can you name one thing that Kevin McCarthy has ever planted his flag on like the policy side?
He's not really a policy guy, but he is really good at raising money. And he's good at the glad handing part, which is also really important for being a speaker. So that's the flip side of it. Now, there is something that he has been working on for a while, and that has been maintaining a strong relationship with Trump.
Yes.
I've been told that they spoke as recently as this week. They speak a few times a week. He's got one of his staffers, Brian Jack, who runs his congressional fundraising committee, his congressional leadership committee, working for Trump. They have Trump really likes Brian Jack. They have a good relationship. Trump and McCarthy, even despite the tapes that leaked after impeachment, when he was sort of slagging off some of the members and talking about what a mess it was, you know, he's managed to keep Trump in his pretty good graces, because ultimately Trump could be the one to decide if he's speaker or not. Like, his say is much stronger than any member of the Freedom Caucus. Now, it was pointed out to me that just yesterday, probably because I think people are talking about the anxiety that Kevin McCarthy will have if his speakership looks this narrow, he did tweet something. Like, he tweeted something on, sorry, he truthed something, basically saying that, like, Kevin McCarthy is a great patriot. And it was like, as far as you gotten towards in terms of an endorsement for speaker. He did, I think a few months ago, he actually endorsed him for his congressional seat, but he didn't go so far as to endorse him for speaker. And he said that, he made that clear. He's kind of keeping his powder dry too. But at the same time, like, all of the Freedom Caucus members and staffers, everyone that I've spoken to says, well, Trump's in it for McCarthy, so we're probably not going to turn on him. But Trump turns on McCarthy, not good.
Right. And you gotta remember, there's a window between November, like, say Republicans win the House. Then in January, when they come back together, that's when they have their leadership election, right?
Right.
So there's a little bit of a gap there, if anything slips or changes. You've also been doing some reporting from inside McCarthy's donor retreat, which was recently in Jackson Hole, right?
Yeah, it was.
So what was the read there? Are they moving in a more pessimistic direction about the size of their incoming majority, or was it all rainbows and unicorns?
It wasn't rainbows and unicorns, and I don't know if rainbows and unicorns motivate donors anyway. So yeah. I don't know. He did say, conservatively, 15 seats. If things stay the way they are right now, they'll win 15 seats. So that's not really much of a majority.
Yeah.
He also acknowledged that abortion is not polling well, and that, you know, 70% of Americans want the right to choose, 30% are pro-life. So, or anti-abortion, however you want to say it. So yeah, I mean, it was not like, it wasn't rainbows and butterflies. And he also didn't factor in turnout in terms of if Trump announces that he's going to run before the midterms, although I'm hearing that it's less likely that that's going to happen. And like, while they were like actually planning an event for Trump to announce, are not doing that right now, and there's no plan to. In fact, it'll probably happen after the midterms at this point. But then at the same time, everyone who it's close to him, it's like, he could tweet it tonight for all we know. You know what I mean? Like, there's just that, there's always that X factor. And Trump is always the X factor. And really all that McCarthy can do is like, give these members some things and keep Trump sweet. Things have changed.
As much as it feels icky, there's actually not many Republicans you can name who have been better at surfing Trump's whims and emotions than Kevin McCarthy. I mean, Kevin McCarthy went from condemning Donald Trump after January 6th to flying to Mar-a-Lago a week later and taking a thumbs up picture with him. I mean, like, he is shameless in that respect. And so in a sense, like you said, he's a really good operator. So he'll be good at quote unquote herding cats, as Bill Frist said. But if he's really good at managing his relationship with Trump, the last thing I want to ask you is, like, in that MAGA Freedom Tea Party caucus in the House Republican caucus, who is he closest with? Is it, I mean, like, is Steve Scalise still in that crew? I mean, he's the Republican whip, or is Scalise now seen as too establishment? Like, who is McCarthy close with on the
far right? I think Scalise is a rival.
Yeah.
I think Scalise is someone from his time in the Republican Study Committee might be seen as someone more palatable to the House Freedom Caucus. I think right now, like, McCarthy's really trying to make nice with these Freedom Caucus guys, like giving Jim Jordan that post. I would say maybe Jim Banks ends up being majority whip as a sort of concession as well. They were annoyed with him for first backing Liz Cheney, right? Like, you know, he spared her the first time around. Spared her. When you say it like that. But you know what I mean? From what she was up against. I think for McCarthy, like, he's actually put in a lot of time with Trump, and Trump actually really likes him at this point. They have just like a personal rapport. Because I always ask people, I'm like, what's the difference between McCarthy and McConnell? Like, what they did was basically the same, right? Don't you think, after impeachment?
Yeah. I mean, I think McConnell like stuck to his guns a little bit more.
Yeah, he didn't run off separation to Mar-a-Lago days later and say, I'm so sorry, you know.
Right.
But the crime, like, and how many people have turned on Trump and haven't been able to get back into the inner circle, right? Mm-hmm. There was definitely like a tense stretch, I think, for McCarthy and Trump. You know, Trump compartmentalized it. And I think he also probably realizes if he's going to run for president himself, like, it wouldn't really be the time to pick the Speaker of the House, right? I think he's probably just thinking, I'll ride it out with McCarthy.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you say that Trump has sort of like put the run for office thing on ice for a bit. I mean, I feel like 1 month ago, this gossip was percolating everywhere that Trump was going to announce before the midterms. He might truth something out, but yeah. It does feel like that has sort of been put on pause for the minute.
He's definitely preoccupied. There's something to be said for that. I mean,
Yes, he is.
Seriously.
Yes, he is.
And he's already dominating the conversation so much for Republicans. I mean, I can't.
Well, that was the issue, was in the course of that conversation, the idea that Trump felt like he wasn't getting enough attention, you know, his insecurity was flaring. And now with the, you know, FBI classified document thing, he is, you know, he might be in legal jeopardy, but he's back in the center of the conversation. And maybe that's made him reevaluate announcing before the midterms.
Yeah, because ultimately that's where he wants to be, at the center of the conversation. And I do think he thinks that the Republican Party has coalesced around him because of this. But
exactly.
See, that's right.
All right, Tara. Well, enjoy your birthday and have a great holiday weekend. Coming up, Ben and Bill are here to read the Federal Reserve tea leaves.
Welcome back. I'm Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck, joined here today by Bill Cohan, who I assume is here to tell me why I should have sold out of my position in Bed Bath & Beyond.
Well, first of all, Ben, it's always nice to be on with you. And as you know, we don't provide investment advice here at Puck. So I could have given you some thoughts, but, you know, you were free to do whatever you wanted because it's not investment advice.
It's all in the blind trust anyway. But no, what I really wanted to talk to you about is Jerome Powell.
J. Powell
to his friends, the Fed chairman, who has been signaling to markets for some time now that a steep market correction is needed to get inflation under control. And investors are sort of kind of getting the message. And then they forget again, and inflation looks like it's cooling off and stocks rip, which we saw. And then they dropped again when Powell got out at Jackson Hole and made a little speech. What does he need to do to get the attention of markets? Set himself on fire?
Look, there's no constituency for markets falling, interest rates increasing. So, you know, who likes that? People like it when the market goes up. They like it when money is free or close to free. Now, people on fixed incomes, people who have retired, people who rely on interest on bonds to, you know, pay their bills and live, you know, they like it. They've been screwed for the last 13 years, and they like it when interest rates increase because they get a higher rate of interest. But, you know, the vast majority of people like free money and increasing stock market pricing and increases in their portfolio. Even though, of course, if you're clever, you can make a lot of money or as much money or even more, infinite amounts of money or what seem like infinite amounts of money if you bet correctly when the stock market is going down or when bonds are going down. That's sophisticated stuff and scary. So, you know, Jay Powell has a problem that in the past when he's talked about increasing rates and then actually doing it, like in 2018, somehow in February of 2019, Donald Trump had dinner with him and got him to reverse course. We still don't know what happened at that dinner. We'd love to know what happened at that dinner. But he did reverse course and unwound the interest rate increases that he made. And then, of course, in the pandemic, did it all again. So, you know, does he have credibility to actually do what he says he's going to do? You know, again, I feel like this time it will be different because he's already gotten his second term. He's not going to get a third. You know, I think he realizes now that inflation is not transitory and it's for real, and he's got to do something about it because, after all, that is one of the two, you know, mandates of the Fed, or one of the two mandates that they, you know, pretend to be the mandates of the Fed, even though the Fed can pretty much do whatever it wants whenever it needs to. So I think that's what he's up against. And even though the inflation numbers looked slightly better last month, you know, people went nuts and pretended that the interest rate increases were over or might be over or might be slowing down. And so our buddy had to jerk investors back to reality in Jackson Hole last week. So that's what he did.
Yeah, one thing that's funny about the Fed is that obviously they can go into the market and manipulate rates by changing the window for interest rates or buying bonds on the market. But also there's this expectation setting that the Fed chairman does just in terms of the word choice that they use. People like to call this Fed speak. So what were some of the things, some of the words that Powell used at Jackson Hole that got investors so spooked?
Pain. That's probably a good one. Families are going to experience pain.
Investors didn't like that.
No. I mean, and we're going to be vigilant about fighting inflation, and that means raising interest rates, and there's going to be pain for American families. And all that's true. And by the way, it's all as a result of the previous 13 years of Fed policy, which, you know, was way, way, way out on a limb, many standard deviations away from the norm. You know, in part, I get why they had to do quantitative easing 1, 2, 3, 4 ad nauseum. I mean, I think there was, it was very creative, very clever, and some limited amount of quantitative easing was justifiable. But to just let it go on and on and on for 13 years, frankly, is reprehensible, and manipulated interest rates into a place where now, you know, we have to pay the price. So instead of, you know, taking the punch bowl away when the party's getting started, which is the Fed's mandate, according to a former Fed chairman, William McChesney Martin, the Fed under the last three Fed chairmen have been literally pouring tequila into the punch bowl with no mixer, just straight tequila. So, you know, it's been a party, and now the party's over.
Do you think that some of this signaling by Powell is kind of bullshit on some level? Like, he used the word pain. Wall Street didn't like that. The markets dropped down again. And he invoked Paul Volcker, his predecessor during the Carter era. But Volcker got inflation under control by absolutely crushing the economy. I mean, he raised rates up to like 20% or something. You could tell me the exact number, but we're nowhere near there. And I wonder if this is just sort of signaling on some level, or if this actually indicates how far we think Powell might really go.
Jay Powell has not consulted with me. I have to stipulate that for listeners. I've never spoken to him in my life. I once spoke to Ben Bernanke, and he got angry at me for suggesting that their policy was flawed and that quantitative easing was somehow, not the greatest thing in the world to continue to do after its first benefits were achieved, and had added to the mispricing of risk across the board, across assets, and it created all these asset bubbles. So obviously, the Fed gestalt is not to take blame for these kinds of things. But yeah, so I mean, I think a lot of Fed communication is, sort of a magician's act, smoke and mirrors, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain kinds of things, and is very much signaling. And without giving too much away, I think he's trying to set the groundwork for a major financial correction in the financial markets, or at least to get the financial markets less euphoric, driving up interest cost on the riskiest assets. So he's jawboning interest rates up, even though, the Fed fund rates are still, targeted 2.25%, 2.5%, and still have a long way to go before real interest rates are positive. And so that's what Volcker did. He made real interest rates positive by jacking up the Fed funds rate to, 15% plus, which made all interest rates much higher. He could be sowing the seeds, for a huge rally in the bond market. The bond market has basically been uninvestable for a long time since QE started and ZERP started. And, this is in effect making the bond market investable again, which is probably a good thing, but is definitely a good thing. But there's going to be a lot of pain for all the people who missed priced risk in the last 13 years.
Well, thanks, Bill. That's terrifying, and I'm not going to look at my 401k again until you tell me it's safe. But thanks for stopping by. Appreciate it, as always.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Peter Hamby. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, and Chris Corcoran, chief content officer and founding partner of Cadence 13.